Hello listeners, and welcome to today's podcast where we invite our guests to bear all and spill the tea. Today's Spill the Tea podcast is brought to you by me, Chris Jones from All Saints Academy. I'm pleased to welcome my co-hosts, Tallulah Robin Redmond and Harry Searle from Balcarra School, and Riley Simmons and Hallie Jones from Cleve School. Joining us, we have the pleasure of welcoming our guest, Dr. Rob Chappell. Dr. Chappell went to Sheffield Medical School 40 years ago and is soon to retire. He is currently senior partner at St. George's Surgery at St. Paul's Medical Centre in Cheltenham. He qualified in 1986 and spent 4 years working in hospital before going to his general practice training. At the end of this, he did 3 years occupational medicine with Oxford Motors and STEW and was an honorary lecturer at Birmingham University. Listening to his heart, he decided to return to his first love, clinical medicine and general practice. And he joined St. George's Surgery in January 1995, where he has been ever since. Dr. Chappell has been a GP trainer for over 20 years, teaching and examining medical students and training young GPs. He is married and has 4 grown-up children, none of whom are doctors. Welcome, Dr. Chappell.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you.
Hi, Dr. Chappell. Thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. Our first question is, what advice would you give your younger self during the application process for medical school?
That's a very good question. I think my advice would be to have the courage to say what you think and not what you think other people want to hear. When I was about 14 or 15 years old, I was standing with a group of friends at the school tuck shop. In front of us was a boy of our age who was not particularly cool or popular. And one of my group, for no reason at all, went up behind him and kneed him in the back of the thigh. The boy dropped like a sack of potatoes. There was a horrified silence and no one quite knew what to say or do. And then I suddenly heard myself say, "Jesus, Nixon, why did you do that?" And suddenly everything changed. Nixon looked embarrassed and ashamed, and his friends rounded on him, and the poor lad on the floor was helped to his feet. What I learned in that moment was that if you think something, then lots of other people think the same. And far from looking a fool, people will look up to you and ask for your advice. So obviously, when you're applying to medical school, you've got to have an understanding of why you want to do medicine, and you need to have the intellectual ability to formulate an answer. But once you've done that, don't be afraid to articulate your thoughts and ideas. You won't be wrong, and your originality and honesty will be exactly what they're looking for.
And what advice would you give to other aspiring medical students before their interview?
I think they really do need to drill down into why they want to be a doctor. They need to explain to the examiners that they understand what's required of them. And medicine's a combination of two things, really. One is science, so you have to be interested and reasonably competent at the science subjects. But you also have to understand that the practice of medicine is an art, and it's about communication and communicating with people. So I think if you can demonstrate your understanding of those two things, then you're 3/4 of the way to explaining why you want to be a doctor.
Thank you, Dr. Chappell.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because I think lots of the time when thinking about medicine and applicants, I feel like don't really think about, I suppose, like the more softer side of like the soft skills and things like that, communication. And
I think that's right, yes.
Mm. So what drove you towards becoming a GP rather than any other specialty?
I'm a romantic at heart, actually, so I've got a romantic answer for you. As a child, I was always interested in houses, and I always imagined that the large house in any village was the doctor's house as we drove around the countryside on a Sunday. I come from a long line of doctors, and so I was always aware of the role of certainly the country doctor, the role that a country doctor played within his community. And this was reinforced by films of the time, such as The Railway Children and a TV series in the early 70s about a thoroughbred horse called Black Beauty. So I always had a romantic idea of living in a rose-covered cottage serving a local community. And although I live in a town in a modern semi-detached house, a key element of my romantic view has been achieved, really. My practice as a GP is concerned with people and their families and their lives, sickness and health, people's journey through life, sharing their triumphs and tragedies. These are all human stories, and there's nowhere else I'd rather be. Yeah.
And what impact has COVID-19 had on the way you work in your practice?
An enormous impact, and I think your question leads on to another one, which is, will we go back to how we were before? So COVID really has changed every aspect of the way we work. Because of the need to prevent the spread of COVID to both vulnerable patients and to protect the thin line of cold-faced medical workers, we moved almost overnight from face-to-face consultations to remote consulting. Assessing patients, making decisions and managing problems over the telephone is much harder than when seeing someone face-to-face. You're working in a very compromised position, it's time consuming and it's inefficient. Contrary to what you may have heard, we've continued seeing people face to face throughout the pandemic, but we're all anxious to increase the face to face contact as quickly as possible. Coinciding really with the remote working is changes in technology, which I think are here to stay. There've been some improvements. We're using electronic things for transferring photographs, which has some limited value for problems such as skin lesions and other skin problems. But for most things, one still needs to see the patient. General practice is incredibly efficient. It manages 90% of NHS contacts, but receives just 10% of the NHS budget. Because of this efficiency, it's been taken advantage of with a relentless transfer of secondary care workload into or onto primary care. General practice is teetering on the verge of collapse, as evidenced by the massive shortage of GPs across the country. In the world we live in, the solution to any problem is always technological, and there's no shortage of IT companies willing to sell their products as the answer to all ills. During the COVID period, there's been a new initiative called eConsult, which has been rolled out across the country. It's sold as a sort of technological innovation that allows both the patient easy access to their GP and an interface where GPs can filter work and signpost problems to other healthcare workers, freeing up precious GP time and making things ever more efficient. New things always take time to bed in, and any change is always resisted by the people having to do the changing. But eConsult in its current form is not working. Patients are frustrated and GPs are drowning. Using eConsult, the patient or the worried well, or simply the board, can wing off an email as they watch Match for Day 2 on a Sunday night, asking anything from, does having an itch on my left forearm mean anything? To if my granny had bowel cancer, can I or should I have some sort of test? So when we go on Monday morning, there are 520 e-consults sitting there. It takes a whole day just to read them, let alone answer them. So it's a real problem. The current system simply can't cope with this form of demand, and it gets in the way of seeing the people who really need to be seen. It's frustrating for patients and doctors alike, and it's dangerous. What will continue? I think that eConsult is likely to continue, albeit in an altered form, to combat the GP shortage, the NHS is employing more and more allied professionals to fill the gap. Clinical pharmacists, paramedics, physician associates, advanced nurse practitioners, many of whom have much to offer, but these people are expensive, more expensive than increasing the number of doctors because there's so many more of them. And for most people, what they want is someone who they know and trust, and someone who has the higher professional training to be able to make decisions on their behalf, because as you'll find out in life, making decisions is the hardest thing you do. So in summary, COVID has broken the automatic face-to-face contact with your family doctor, and although there'll be a return to more normal working, the patient will find that a lot of contact with their surgeon will be less personal, with a greater use of technology such as e-consult, and interaction will be with a wider range of professionals and less continuity of care from their own GP. So I think it's had a profound effect, and it will continue to have a profound effect.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that you made about the volume of e-consults coming in and how you're supposed to deal with that sort of number.
Yes, yeah. And of course, the danger of it is that it literally takes a morning just to sift out which ones are important and need to be dealt with that morning, and you find it's 12 o'clock.
How would you like to see e-consult going forward in the future? Like, how do you think that would be the most efficient use of time and things like that?
I think you can't just have an open door. What I've noticed is that the people, I don't know if you've tried to ring your GP, but I think this is universal. This has been rolled out across the country. So normally you would just ring up your surgery and ask for an appointment and you'd be given one. Well, you can't have one anymore because of the face-to-face problem. So what you're offered is the doctor will phone you back. But that's been replaced by e-consult, where you're asked by the receptionist to send in this email. And what I've noticed is that the people who master it, which are generally the young people, they think, oh, that's quite cool. And so 3 days later, they get a kind of twitch in their left ear, and they think, oh, I can wing one of those things off. And so people are using it, not unreasonably, in a way that they think, okay, but they wouldn't normally have rung up their doctor with that particular problem before. But so that ease of access has to be controlled somehow. And I don't know how it's going to pan out, but help, if you can think of a solution, just come and talk to me.
I'll get thinking.
I think it's really interesting on how you have spoken about how COVID-19 had to change the way hospitals and the NHS as a whole runs.
Yes.
But I was wondering, how's the NHS benefited in any way from the pandemic?
Well, that again is a great question. The NHS was already held in high regard by the British public, and rightly so. One is always hearing about how it's underfunded, but the truth is that the struggle to provide ever more complex and expensive services to an ageing population isn't unique to Britain. It's true for all first world countries across the globe. What the NHS does well, I think, is that it is comparatively very efficient, and the quality of service provision is remarkably uniform across the whole country. The NHS, of course, isn't free. It's simply free at the point of contact, but you still pay for it through taxation. I think that's quite important to remember, because I think sometimes the idea that it's free can make the NHS into a sort of sacred cow and a political football, preventing some necessary changes. We're all aware of a horror show that is the US healthcare system, but there are alternative healthcare systems in European countries that work perfectly well, and which are not necessarily free at the point of contact, but which manage this issue in other ways. So to get back to your question, I think the pandemic has reaffirmed the public's love for the NHS, but no, the NHS cannot benefit from the pandemic. The pandemic's a disaster for the NHS. And it will take many years to recover from it.
Yeah, thank you. I think that as a society, we've kind of fallen back into the thing as the NHS isn't just burning a hole in our pocket, it's more we're paying for the help we need.
Yes.
So it's hard in the sense that it's put a strain on the NHS, but then I think the sense of communities kind of came back from the general public, which has kind of helped them a bit with like the clapping on the Thursdays and stuff, which kind of reintroduces kind of a sense of unity.
I think that's absolutely right and very well articulated.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes, I agree with what you said about how sometimes then the NHS didn't really benefit from the pandemic, and I thought that sometimes the public took advantage of the NHS before the pandemic came around, and now it's more of a thing that they need it more, and they're not really, and they're using it in ways that they actually need, unlike how you could come in for the smallest thing before the pandemic actually came around. And I was going to ask, what are your views on the on how the government and the NHS has responded to the pandemic?
Well, that's a very topical question. Well done. I don't know. Dominic Cummings is a very interesting person. Do you all know Dominic Cummings? He was talking yesterday. He's obsessed with the idea that it is individuals who make the difference. He's utterly dismissive and disparaging of the collective. But occasionally it's true. The collective can be slow and safe and ineffective. And I think that the masterstroke of the UK vaccination programme was Boris Johnson taking decisive action right at the beginning and instructing Kate Bingham, a venture capitalist with a lifetime's experience in dealing with pharmaceutical companies, with a simple task of, and I quote, to save lives and as soon as possible. It was she, rather than a committee, who dealt directly with the drug companies and got the contracts that allowed the UK to roll out its vaccination programme so early and so quickly. Vaccinations are the only way out of this pandemic, and so I think the government can be commended for how it acted so decisively right at the beginning. As regards how the NHS has responded to COVID, I think its crowning glory has again been the vaccination rollout. What's been so effective is the way it's been managed and delivered at a local level. I do think it's been a Dunkirk experience. It's local practices and pharmacists and volunteers coming together, working long and extra hours, delivering the jabs in an incredibly efficient manner at a local level. As you know, here in Cheltenham, we use the local fire station, and it's there jabbing people 7 days a week from early in the morning to late in the evening. So I think that I think both of them get a tick from me, probably.
Yeah, thank you. I do agree with how it was good that the government did take firm action, how Boris did take firm action at the beginning of the pandemic, and how the NHS rollout of the jabs have been very quick, and it's going very quick at the moment as well with getting all the age groups done. So
yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So obviously COVID's been catastrophic in the ways of symptoms and infection, how it's spread. And obviously, as we're kind of, I don't want to say coming out the other side, but we're nearing to a sense of normality again. Do you think that people's attitudes towards hospitals and medical treatments have changed as a result of COVID?
Yes, another good question. I think that the British public have been very understanding of the situation the hospitals and general practice were put in. They recognised that the focus of all these services had to shift almost overnight to dealing with COVID patients, and just as importantly, protecting other patients and healthcare workers from getting the disease themselves. So for this reason, last year people stopped using services unless it was essential for them to do so. But people have now waited over a year, and there's a backlog of medical problems that now need to be dealt with, particularly non-life-threatening but important conditions and procedures, things such as hip replacements, cataract operations, hearing aid fitments, surveillance scans and colonoscopies. The waiting lists are going to be enormous, and I think as we now begin to come out of the pandemic, there will be a change in people's attitudes as they get frustrated when they can't get what they want when they want. We're going to have to manage people's expectations, I think.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, because of all the different things that have been going on with COVID, as well as new doctors and nurses coming in, because of what's been happening now, and if something similar could happen in the future, what other advice would you give to someone interested in a medical career, in a career in the medical field, even in and out of a pandemic?
Well, I think what advice would I give to someone interested in a career? What other advice would I give to somebody interested in going into medicine? I think I'd tell them to think really long and hard about why they wanted to be a doctor. It's a big decision to make when you're just 17 or 18 years old. It seems a fairly obvious choice to make at that age if you're good at sciences and got the ability to get top grades. It sounds like you'll be doing a noble thing, and there's a comforting career pathway set out before you. But, and there is a but, you're entering a tunnel which professionally you're not going to get out of. So you need to understand what you need to be a good doctor. You need to be robust, you really do. You need to understand it will be working long hours. You'll be scared a lot of the time. You won't be able to find the answers to all your problems in a book or on the internet. And you'll be making decisions, often just informed guesses, really, every single day. And some of your decisions will be wrong, and you'll have to be able to live with that. You can't be half in and half out. You have to commit 100% all of the time for your whole career. So those are the personal qualities you need to possess, quite apart from your knowledge and your intellect. And it's no disgrace to say that's not for me. If you can get top grades in science A-levels, you could go to a Russell Group university, and via the grad schemes have a vast array of exciting and rewarding careers open to you. So I'd say think long and hard about why you want to be a doctor and give plenty of thought to your other options. That's what I'd say.
Yeah, thank you. I think if people are interested, it's always good to think through everything that they're going to do, even if it's just a small decision that they have to make, something small in the medical field, but it could affect them long term. It's always good to have a long think before something actually happens.
Yes. One of the joys of medicine, I think, is that there are so many different branches of medicine that, our personalities are all different, and my personality is suited for being a GP. And there are other jobs that would suit other personalities within medicine. So it's not too narrow a tunnel. There are options, but you will be a doctor. Doctors don't become other people. If you do physics at Cambridge, you can do all sorts of things. You could go and be a lawyer, you could be a teacher, you could join Unilever, you could go into a research lab. But if you're a doctor, you're a doctor, and you're making that decision at 17 or 18, which is really tough, I think.
Yeah, so if you had to choose a fictional doctor from a film or a television show, which one is your favourite and why would that be?
Ha! So I generally try and avoid medical programmes because they annoy me, most of them. Holby City, is that a hospital one?
Yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't like that at all. And Casualty also, not for me. But Sebastian Faure, do you know Sebastian Faure, the writer? He's great. Anyhow, he wrote a book called A Possible Life, which is a collection of 5 short stories. The 5th story in it is set in the near future, so it's in the future, but only about 10 years away. And it's in Italy, and I confess I can't really remember the details, but as I remember it, the world is in economic collapse and everything that we take for granted has gone. And the family of a little girl who live in the Italian countryside have to take their daughter to see a doctor in the local town. Nothing's working. Transport, lighting, shops. But somehow they get the girl to the clinic. And after a long wait, they're ushered in to see the doctor. Faulks describes him as looking exhausted and smelling of cigarette smoke. in his stained white coat. And the doctor's got nothing to offer in terms of treatment other than his time and his soft words. And that stayed with me, that image. It works at a lot of different levels. I think it's about not taking things for granted, realising how lucky we are, understanding that things can change, as evidenced by the pandemic, you know, that came out of nowhere. And it's about the human aspect of somebody who's serving people. He's tired, he's exhausted, and he's offering himself as the treatment because he has no penicillin. But the family and the little girl get succor from him and his time. So there you go. I'd like to be him.
Yeah. Well, I think that's really powerful. Honestly, if someone had asked me the same question, I would have said Dr. Watson from Sherlock Holmes because I think he's pretty cool. But no, that's really, really amazing. Yeah. Now, this is the question that we all really, really want to know the answer to. How well behaved were you at school?
Oh, well, I was a good boy, really. But in my immaturity, I tried hard not to conform. I was educated by Benedictine monks, and they're a fairly worldly order, so I was able to smoke and go to the pub, because he could in those days. I was reported to my parents once for public drunkenness, and my father just laughed, and my mother said, "Bobby, admonish him." I did community service rather than join the CCF. And then the worst thing I did was I willfully stopped playing rugby so I could spend more time with Monica Whitlock Blundell, whom I'd fallen in love with. And I never made school prefect.
Now, we really wouldn't be spilling the tea properly if we didn't ask you a few gritty questions at the end to find out the stuff our listeners really want to know. At the end of all our podcasts, we are asking our final #33 questions to really juice things up for our listeners. Our guests haven't been sent these final 33 questions, so now is our chance to really get to know them.
Okay, so first up, what is the most outrageous thing you've seen in your career so far?
Outrageous? Gosh. I'm assuming by outrageous you mean something medically or morally reprehensible. I'm going to sound a bit pompous here, I think. But it strikes me that actually doctors in general are remarkably bright, intelligent, emotionally intelligent, I mean, hardworking, caring, pretty well-rounded group of people. I'm sure there's bad apples in there, but I'm sure they could hold their heads up high and being compared to another group. And why is that? I think it's because of the natural selection at your age. You know, you're people like you, you know, good people, and because the work's so demanding. If I think back, I can remember being outraged once. I was working as a medical student in Los Angeles in 1984. I was doing an elective in medical oncology. Just as AIDS exploded onto the scene. So I was really at a kind of amazing point and moment in time, being in LA in 1984 doing medical oncology, this explosion of AIDS. We had a patient who was dying. He was cachectic. Do you know, it was a nice word, horrible thing, but nice word. Cachectic, very thin and gaunt and clearly dying. And he was unconscious. And he'd obviously been transferred from the prison to the hospital. And he was manacled to the end of his bed by this enormous leg iron. And it just seemed wrong. And so I spoke to the consultant who was American, but he'd worked in the UK as well. And he agreed with me. And with much persuasion, he managed to get the guard to take it off so that the man could die unchained.
Wow, I think that's a really, really interesting story.
I agree. I think it's really nice how you've kind of valued the fact that he is dying, and you've kind of taken into account how he would probably want to die by unchaining him and kind of letting him die as a free man.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So looking back on your life, if you had to thank one person, whether you know them or not, that is at the centre of everything that you've done and that is your ultimate inspiration, who is that and why?
One person?
Yeah.
No, I'm not having that. That was a lovely question. Well, my adult children are currently my ultimate inspiration. I'm very admiring of them and proud of them. But they couldn't have been my inspiration through my life because they didn't exist when I was young. My parents were my inspiration when they were young. My father was a doctor. He was a kind and gentle man who raised a high office. He could talk to anyone. He hated pomposity and pretense. Professionally, I was houseman to a chap called Professor Larry Ramsey, who was a down-to-earth Glaswegian who bucked the trend of typically Oxbridge-educated medical professors. He was talented and caring and clever. He could see who was really good and who wasn't. You know, he just had an eye for that. He's influenced me more than anybody else in my medical career. But one more, I'm afraid. The one person who stayed with me and soundtracked my life is Bob Dylan. As Joan Baez, do you know Joan Baez? Diamonds and Rust, you must go and listen to Diamonds and Rust. It's her love song to him. Very sad. As Joan Baez once said, you know, for some people, they can either take him or leave him. But for others, it goes way deep, and Bob Dylan goes way deep for me. There you go. Sorry, it was more than one.
That's fine.
So, what is the worst piece of advice that you've ever been given?
It's usually me who gives myself bad advice. Worst piece of advice? How about if you hit a golf ball just a little bit harder, it's bound to go further. That's bad advice. And you can use that as a metaphor.
Quite good advice. So, Rob, you've been absolutely fantastic, and thank you for spilling the tea here with us at All Saints Academy.
This podcast is brought to you by the Cheltenham Educational Partnership, and it's been fantastic to work alongside our partner secondary schools to get to know our surrounding professionals even more.
Listeners, thank you for listening to our first broadcast of Spill the Tea podcast. We have loved meeting different people from all sorts of specialisms in life, and we can't wait to release more interviews next year. Make sure you follow us at ASA Chout and Chout EduPart on Twitter, and like our Facebook and Instagram pages to keep up to date with what we are doing next. Thanks for tuning in, and join us all again soon to
Spill the Tea!
Today's Spill the Tea podcast was brought to you by the Cheltenham Educational Partnership.